From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President-elect Joe Biden is expected to announce his intention to nominate Democratic Congresswoman Marsha Fudge of Ohio to be the next Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and Tom Vilsack to return to his old job leading the Department of Agriculture. Fudge would be Biden's second high-profile Black cabinet choice so far. Civil rights groups have been calling on Biden to make his incoming administration more diverse. Derek Johnson is president of the NAACP. He met with the Biden team yesterday, and he joins me now to talk more about this. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So, Derek, during your meeting with President-elect Biden, you urged him to create a new cabinet position, reporting directly to the president on racial justice, similar to what he plans to do with climate by appointing former Secretary of State John Kerry as White House climate envoy. Why is this kind of cabinet position important?
If the priority is for racial equity, there needs to be someone charged with the responsibility to ensure that the vision of the president as stated is carried out across all of the agencies and his cabinet appointments. You see it in corporate America, where corporations who understand the value of diversity and inclusion, they empower a diversity and inclusion officer who reports to the president and CEO of the corporation, because that's now a new business model. We're saying for this administration, it should be a part of our business model, our citizen model, to bring in something different and new to really change how we view racial equity and opportunity.
Hmm. Was Biden receptive to that idea? And what else did you all talk with him about yesterday?
It was a great conversation. We had the vice president-elect in the conversation, and we talked about several issues from reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act to the important role of the Justice Department. And it was our opportunity as civil rights leaders to open up the dialogue, because their success will be the success of this country. And we want to make sure we can do all we can to provide the level of input and have an ongoing dialogue.
As part of this ongoing dialogue with the incoming Biden administration, the NAACP has been calling for Biden to nominate Fudge to be Secretary of Agriculture. What's your reaction to Biden now planning to nominate her to the head of Housing and Urban Development instead?
Congresswoman Fudge is an extremely talented member of Congress, and she will be successful wherever she lands if she decides to join the cabinet. We would love to see someone of her caliber, her skill, to be in the Department of Agriculture. She served for many years on the Agriculture Committee as a subcommittee chair over child nutrition. And we appreciate the fact that Department of Ag, two-thirds of their budget is around food nutrition. So we wanted someone there to put a greater emphasis to address not only child hunger, but quality food delivery opportunities for everyone.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other cabinet picks so far. They've been more diverse than past administrations. In addition to Representative Fudge at HUD, Biden is expected to nominate retired General Lloyd Austin to head the Department of Defense, as we've been talking about. Do you think Biden heard the criticism from your organization and other groups pushing for more Black cabinet nominees? Do you feel like your campaign worked?
Well, you know, he stated over and over that he will have the most diverse cabinet in history. And we believe his word to be true. But it's our job to create the conditions where statements he made become the reality that we see.
Ravi Perry, chair of the political science department at Howard University, told NPR's All Things Considered yesterday that he's happy so far with Biden's commitment to more diversity in his administration. But he says representation itself should not be the end goal. Let's listen.
Let's remember that, you know, the president and vice president, they're going to be appointing hundreds and hundreds and thousands of positions. And so, you know, if we're just focused on the symbolism of descriptive representation at the cabinet level, then we might lose the fact that what we really need in these civil rights groups, we need the substantive representation.
I hear what you're saying about what the role of the NAACP is in really pushing, even if the Biden administration is taking this up on their own. But what do you think of the idea that Ravi Perry made here?
Absolutely agree. And that's why we started with the proposition that it's going to be the priority of racial equity that need to be across all agencies, regardless of who's appointed. So whether the appointment, male, female, Black, white, young, old, They understand the directive coming from the West Wing of the White House, from the president's office, is a mandate that racial equity is a priority, so that when we finish the 4 years, we can not only celebrate the diversity of the cabinet, we will be able to celebrate the opportunity of the diversity of our nation through a racial equity lens.
That's Derek Johnson, president of the NAACP. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, an investigation is underway in the UK after the new Pfizer coronavirus vaccine caused an allergic reaction in two recipients there. Now, both people have a history of significant allergies already, so new advice has been issued for those who suffer from serious allergies to not take the vaccine at this time. We're going to have more in the program. But what else are health officials grappling with as the vaccine will be rolled out here in the U.S. in the coming days? Helen Branswell of our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine Publication, wrote a terrific checklist. We've picked a few areas of concern. Helen, start with pregnant women. They're excluded from clinical trials because of safety concerns. But then many healthcare workers are pregnant or in this age group. So can pregnant women take the vaccine?
Well, we don't know the answer to that yet. For years, researchers, especially a group at Johns Hopkins University, have been arguing that women are done a disservice when clinical trials for drugs and vaccines do not include women who are pregnant and women who are lactating because the perceived risks, and then at the end you don't have any data. The FDA said early on it wanted vaccine manufacturers to do what are called developmental and reproductive toxicology studies. Those are studies that are done in animals before enrolling pregnant women. Those studies, I think, are underway for both Pfizer and Moderna. The CDC's advisory panel hasn't said anything definitive about this yet. They seem to be leaning towards effectively giving women who are pregnant the choice and explaining to them that there aren't data.
Well, you spoke with the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and they said the same thing. We're going to tell the CDC we don't recommend the vaccine for pregnant people, but we also don't think they should be, you know, precluded from its use. So pregnant women are on their own. And I was astonished, Helen, about half of all the pregnant people in this country are either healthcare workers or have some sort of medical condition that might put them at risk of having a severe case if they contract it. I mean, that's just amazing that that many of the pregnant people in this country are, you know, nurses, doctors, healthcare workers. So right now they're on their own and making that decision. What about children? We know that Pfizer, when it went to its second phase trial, did include children age 12 and up, but no children below 12 have received even a test vaccine. Can children now get vaccinated, and should they? What's the thinking?
So with children, you know, we're in the same situation. There aren't data, and the studies that need to be done haven't even been started when you're talking about kids under the age of 12. But younger kids in particular rarely experience severe COVID disease, so they are probably going to be the last or among the last to get vaccinated. But when you're talking about really young kids, ages, you know, 0 to 11, those studies have to be done very, very carefully. They do what are called dose de-escalation studies. They take the adult dose and sort of dial it back, and they start at the top of that age group. So the, you know, they would start with 11-year-olds and then progress backwards to see that these vaccines are safe and as effective in children as they are in adults.
Yeah. Well, and I just want to mention one thing you do, which is that some children, yes, most children are not getting COVID or reacting as severely to it, but some are. And it's a reminder, as you write, that these vaccines, they do carry a kick, as someone told you. Even adults will have, you know, a couple days of not feeling that great. So there's concern that, you know, how will that be for children? But I just want to move on to what these vaccines will do, because this is fascinating. Once you get a vaccine, can you still infect others? You know, the two vaccines send a messenger into the body that mimics the virus and prompts an immune response. But, you know, people are not quite sure, if I'm reading this correctly, that that means that the vaccine will, you know, just prevent you from getting really sick if you get COVID, or prevent you from getting infected. And if you do get infected, we don't know if you'll shed virus?
That's correct. So the trials were set up essentially to see, do these vaccines prevent symptomatic COVID infection. They don't tell you if they prevent all COVID infection. But what isn't known is whether or not it will stop an infection cold, so that if you were vaccinated and you, you know, encountered somebody who was infected, would your body be able to stave off the infection entirely, or would you get low-level infection in your nose or and throat? Experts like Tony Fauci think that if this happens, probably vaccinated people will not replicate virus as much as people who were unvaccinated and may not emit or shed as much virus, so it might not be a big problem. But, you know, we won't know until these vaccines are in use for a while.
Right. Helen Branswell with our partners at STAT. We'll link you to her terrific article on some of the things health officials here are considering. Helen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Support for Here and Now and the following message is brought to you by the New England Innovation Academy, an innovative engine for students in grades 6 through 12, the first middle and high school that prepares innovators to shape the world through human-centered design. Part world school, part incubator, teaching the cultural dexterity and global focus this era demands. To learn more, visit neiacademy.org.
In the final few weeks of his presidency, the Trump administration plans to execute 5 federal inmates. 2 executions are scheduled for this week, 1 tomorrow, 1 Friday, at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. And by the end of the Trump presidency, 13 inmates will have been put to death since July. It was in the 1800s when Grover Cleveland was president that the U.S. government last executed federal inmates during a presidential transition. Joining us now is Cassandra Stubbs. She's the director of the ACLU Capital Punishment Project, and she joins us now to talk about more on this. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hello.
So 4 men and 1 woman are scheduled for execution this month, all found guilty of horrendous murders. Your organization has long opposed capital punishment, but your reaction to the Trump administration resuming federal executions and carrying them out at such a pace that he has?
In any year, trying to carry out this number of rushed executions would be profoundly troubling. It reduces the amount of time there is for courts to consider each case, and it really harms everyone involved in the process. But to do so during a pandemic, when you're literally increasing the risk of death and serious illness for not just the individuals who participate in the executions, the BOP staff, all of the witnesses, but also the prisoners who are held in the prison facility where these executions are carrying out, it's just really morally bankrupt that the government is going forward in this way.
Yes, we do know there are lots of concerns about carrying out these executions during this time of a pandemic. We know that the Department of Justice reports that members of the execution team have contracted COVID-19 in a prison in Indiana, at least one spiritual advisor who was present at an execution. But I want to ask you about something else. Attorney General Bill Barr has defended the extension of executions into this post-election period, saying he'll likely schedule more before he departs the Justice Department. And he makes this point to say that the way to stop the death penalty is to repeal the death penalty. But when juries impose it, the execution should be carried out. I mean, he has a point here. These inmates were sentenced to the death penalty. Your thoughts?
These 5 individuals, like much of death row in America today, were sentenced decades ago often, and were sentenced most often because of the quality of the lawyering in their cases. When you look at the people who are scheduled for execution, these are people who, without a doubt, if you gave them a fair trial today, would not receive the death penalty. We're talking about, of the 5, 2 men have intellectual disability. It's really beyond dispute. They have powerful claims of intellectual disability, which the Constitution says you can't be executed. And the government is fighting for technicalities that would prevent a court from hearing that evidence. 2 of the cases are by people who did not actually kill anyone. One of the cases, Lisa Montgomery, is, you know, just incredibly horrific personal history. The kinds of things that we know, when fairly presented to juries, allow juries to choose life. So these cases show both the unfairness of the death penalty, and it's just false to say that there is any need to move forward with these in the last days of this administration, particularly after the administration lost the election. And so this, you know, this outdated vision back from the 1990s, when most of America is turning away from the death penalty today, is really out of step.
Yes, state executions have gone out of favor over the decades. 10 states have formally abolished them. And the federal government had actually stopped carrying out executions for almost 2 decades. You're heavily steeped in this issue. Why do you think the Trump administration is doing this at this time?
You know, I really can't. That's such a difficult question, and I can't understand it. I can't understand really how those involved in this are sleeping at night, knowing the risk because of COVID-19. You know, as you alluded to, from the last execution, we know that they tested 8 of the 40 BOP members who were involved in carrying those out, those executions, and 8 of them got COVID. The spiritual advisor of the prisoner who had been quarantining and isolating beforehand, he came to the prison and he got COVID. The fact that they're willing to risk so many potential additional infections at a time when hospitals in Indiana and in this county are completely overwhelmed, when the governors are begging people to stay home, the federal government is just doubling down and scheduled 5 executions at the worst peak of the pandemic. I cannot understand why the federal government has not put on the brakes.
Lisa Montgomery is the first woman to be put to death by the federal government since 1953. And there are 4 others as well that are set to be executed, and they're Black. Can you tell us more about those cases?
Absolutely. You know, when we look at the 4 men who are scheduled, 2 who have intellectual disability, 2 who were not actually the shooters, did not actually kill anyone, we see these are the kinds of cases where racial bias plays out so unfairly in capital cases. We see that Black men are much more likely to be sentenced to death with less evidence. We see that Black men, there are just a number of studies about the role that racial bias plays in both prosecutors' decisions to seek the death penalty and juries' decisions to impose it. And that's a whole nother basis for why these executions should not be allowed to go forward. Nobody whose death sentence has been tainted by racial bias should be executed.
President-elect Joe Biden supported capital punishment 30 years ago, but has changed his mind and wants to eliminate the death penalty. Do you think it's possible for him to do that?
We look forward to working alongside other advocate groups to take President-elect Biden up on his offer to work to end the federal death penalty. He absolutely can show leadership in this area, and he's said that he will work with Congress, and we're looking forward to that.
Cassandra Stubbs is the director of the ACLU Capital Punishment Project. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's go to France now, where President Emmanuel Macron is seeking support today for legislation designed to crack down on extremism. But critics say the proposed bill unfairly targets Muslim communities. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us from Paris. And Eleanor, what is this legislation and what's the argument for why it's needed?
Tanya, you got to understand the atmosphere in France. You know, in the last 5 years, 250 people have been killed in terrorist attacks. And those people killing them were doing it in the name of Islam, even if, you know, clearly it wasn't in the name of a religion, but they claimed that. So there's a link being drawn by many people from ultra-religious people who reject French values like gender equality and free speech. That seemed to be as on the road to radicalism and terrorism. So, you know, you hear stories like some mayors say there's pressure on them to make separate swimming pool hours at the public pool for men and women, or a woman who goes to emergency room with her husband, but she can't see a male doctor. You hear these stories. I don't know how common they are, but this law is going to put an end to people who want to promote their own sort of societal values and laws over the French republics. So, for example, polygamy is already illegal in France, but now you can be denied your residency card if you're, you know, found to be a polygamist. Doctors can be fined and even imprisoned for doing virginity tests on girls. You know, foreign funding for mosques is going to be restricted. Things like this.
This is controversial in other countries. Folks are protesting it, saying that this draft law stigmatizes Muslim people. Tell us more about that criticism.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, for example, Pakistan. Pakistan is a completely different country with a completely different culture where blasphemy is a crime. I think you can, you know, maybe punishable by death. There's no big history of free speech there. So this is seen as just a horrible thing in Pakistan. But the critics of the law within France, they say that, you know, terrorism is not an, you know, an extreme form of religiosity. You can be ultra religious and still respect French values and democracy, and you can be raised as a secular person and become a violent extremist. So, you know, being a terrorist has nothing to do with the religion. And so they say, you know, no one's hurt more by these attacks than Muslims themselves because it's just so horrific. They're treated with suspicion after it happens. So at a time when the French need to be together, Muslims are being stigmatized. And it's being done, this law was presented today on the 115th anniversary to the day of the 1905 law that separated the church and state, that got the Catholic Church out of the government's affairs, that took crucifixes out of classrooms, you see. So France has this long tradition of secularism, but critics say that this secularism, which was supposed to give all religions their space and keep them out of government, is now being twisted and turned into some sort of cudgel to beat Muslims and to stigmatize Muslims and make their religion somehow taboo.
This is all really important context, Eleanor. There's also a lot happening right now. I mean, there's the trial of people charged in connection with the Charlie Hebdo attack. Earlier this fall, a teacher was beheaded. What is happening?
This is all coming at a time when 14 people are on trial right now, accused of helping the two terrorists who did storm the editorial meeting of the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo and killed 12 people. And then you have this Chechen refugee who was radicalized, and he came and found a teacher at a school who used these caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad from Charlie Hebdo to illustrate his class on freedom of speech. And you're right, he beheaded him. So this whole thing is sort of being framed in, like, and this is wrongly, this is the wrong dichotomy. It's not like, do you support the caricatures of Muhammad, then you're for free speech, and if you don't, then you're against free speech. No, it's not about that, but it's sort of becoming framed like that because of events happening. So you see why people can have these different positions and just become hardened in them.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Southwest Airlines is warning some 6,800 employees they could face furloughs, mandatory temporary leaves of absence, the first in the airline's history. The notice comes as the pandemic continues to depress demand for travel in the air and on the ground. Gas consumption over the Thanksgiving weekend hit the lowest level since 1997. For more, we're joined by Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hey, Robin.
So Southwest has never laid off or furloughed employees in its 50 years of flying. But the pandemic, we know, has put this airline and others in a pinch, with labor unions in particular over cost-cutting measures. So what are they looking at in a deficit? What's going on?
Well, they lost more than $1 billion in the third quarter, Robin. So, you know, the unions are saying, hey, they still have some money in the bank. But there's no question that things are as bad as they've ever been at that airline. I mean, this is an airline that almost never lost any money at all through past crises. When you look back to 9/11, the global financial crisis, they always got back on their feet before almost any other airline in the world. And now they're very much in the middle of this one. That $1 billion loss, by the way, compares to nearly a $700 million profit for the same quarter a year earlier, a $2 billion profit in 2019. That's the kind of money Southwest usually makes. It's giving it all back now.
Well, I was going to ask, how is it that they've never been able to, they have been able, they've avoided these involuntary job cuts throughout their history? I mean, how come they're making, you know, so much more money and avoided what sometimes other companies had to do?
Yeah, well, they've been profitable and they've always been growing up until recently. So they always kind of needed more employees, and that was critical to hiring rather than firing people. But a lot of it was that model, that sort of that simple model of one fleet type, turn the plane around quickly, right? Everybody who's flown Southwest knows the plane pulls up to the gate, people get off, people get back on, and get the plane back up in the air. It's been a sustainable model. Not the only way to make money in the airline industry, but nobody has done it as consistently over the decades as Southwest has.
Right. Now, we know that more Americans flew over Thanksgiving than they have since March. Gas sales fell by 19% from last year. That sounds sort of contradictory. But we did see crowded airports over the holiday. So overall, what was the impact of the pandemic on Thanksgiving travel?
Well, travel was way down compared to usual Thanksgiving travel. I mean, for perspective, the day before Thanksgiving, that Wednesday, or the Sunday after Thanksgiving, usually two of the busiest days of the year. And they were the busiest days since the pandemic started, but they were less busy than the least busy day that I can find back in 2019. So air travel down by more than a half, road travel down significantly too, but as you said, by less than a half if you look at those gas sales.
But we're seeing, you know, hospitalizations up. So, you know, health experts are telling us that travel is leading, you know, a little bit later to this surge. So what's the outlook for Christmas?
Well, it'll likely be a lot like Thanksgiving. In fact, compared to the expectations in earlier November, back before the surge got as bad as it ended up getting, the expectations were for significantly more travel than we ended up seeing. So those warnings from health officials and just people's own fears seem to have caused people to back out of some trips that they planned to take. And you could bet that as Christmas approaches that we're also going to see not nearly as many people traveling as usual, even if we see more people traveling than we're seeing today and early into December.
And more infections. Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin. Stay safe.
So where will we live after COVID-19? Architect, city planner, visionary Vishan Chakrabarty has long pushed in his books and TED Talks for more people to live in well-designed, dense cities because, he says, urban living is the greenest and most sustainable choice one can make to save the planet. But cities, think New York, Houston, were some of the hardest hit by COVID-19. We read of people leaving to escape that crush of humanity that drew them there in the first place. Vishan Chakrabarty is founder of the New York-based POW firm, Practice for Architecture and Urbanism. He ran the Manhattan Office of City Planning right after 9/11. He's now dean of the College of Environmental Design at Berkeley and joins us from Berkeley. Vishan, people think of cities as heat islands that waste energy. Make your case.
Sure. So, you know, it really starts with a much simpler idea, which is the village. People live together, and most importantly, that they walk from place to place, right? Like a small village. And it's the same thing is true with our big cities. Most people who live in big cities actually just use a lot less carbon because they walk most places. They tend to live in apartments that heat and cool each other. It's true that cities are heat islands, but that's also because of the numbers of people who live there. So there's about 7 billion people on the planet today. There'll be about 10 billion by 2100. How can those 10 billion people live on the planet given the limited resources that it has? And what I'm arguing is if most of those people live in denser circumstances, not just big cities, but just in more walkable places where they're driving less and they actually know their neighbors more, that they'll probably end up leading healthier lives and more sustainable lives. And we have a lot of data that backs that up, but I think it's also about human culture and who we've always been as a species.
You say people are healthier when they walk. True. Happier because they walk and see people. They're not part of that suburban isolation where you go from your little house to your car to your cubicle and don't see people. They are more productive. They walk or take trains, adding hours to the workday that they're not spending in a commute. But you also talk about how big cities subsidize the suburbs. How so?
Well, they do. I mean, the data is fairly clear on this. In the United States, about 97% of the GDP comes about from about 3% of the landmass. That's not to be disrespectful of all the agriculture that goes on all across the nation. It's incredibly important. But where most of our tax base is generated from is in our big cities. And they do cross-subsidize a lot of the social safety net in a lot of the more rural parts of our economy. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that on its face, but I think we've got to like get rid of the stereotype that it's actually the reverse, that it's our cities that draw down on all of this sort of public money. Mm-hmm. New York City mm-hmm. generates about $1.5 billion of GDP per block. And like when you talk about pandemic and pandemic recovery, for instance, the mass transit systems that are in trouble right now, the school systems that are in trouble right now, the huge housing crisis we're going to have in our cities, we're going to need public money to support those things. And we should understand that if we rebuild our cities correctly coming out of this pandemic, and by the way, historically, cities have always bounced back from pandemics. And it's, you know, a lot of our modern sewer systems and zoning codes come from pandemics in the past. And so if we build our cities back better, the idea will be that those investments will be invaluable to everyone, because if our cities are more prosperous, our countries are more prosperous.
Again, because you say cities subsidize parts of the country with taxes and adding to the GDP. But you also say the government, in many ways, subsidizes our love of cars. Gas should be about $10 a gallon.
When a factory pollutes a river, we ask the factory to clean up the river, right? Economists call that a negative externality. Most economists will tell you that when people drive, they have a huge impact on the rest of us in terms of pollution and congestion. If they paid the actual cost, they'd be paying a lot more for gas. They'd be paying a lot more in taxes. We've been doing this since the 1950s. It was a strategy back at that time to suburbanize the population. And so I'm not talking about removing people's choices. And I think that's when things get really political. I believe people should live where they want to live, but you should have to really pay for the cost of your lifestyle. And if we just like balance the playing field, I think a lot of young people would gravitate back towards those cities.
I think that's the direction they have been going in, right?
Young people have not just been gravitating towards the New Yorks and the Bostons and the San Franciscos, which have became obscenely expensive in the last 10 years, but we've seen a new kind of urban homesteading in Kansas City and San Antonio, Texas, and Buffalo, and what planners used to call second-tier cities have had a huge resurgence. We're seeing fewer and fewer people get driver's licenses. I think people are even questioning, like, is this the way you really want to raise a kid, shuttling them from McMansion to soccer practice in a huge minivan? It's not that pleasant for the people involved. There's more racial segregation. There's more intergenerational segregation. And so I just think a lot of young people are voting with their feet and they're saying we want a different life than what like this 1950s paradigm laid out for us.
Well, so we're speaking now in this pandemic, in this time of COVID. Is that still true? Because we are hearing of people leaving New York City, of entire buildings that house, you know, corporations empty.
I think it's exactly the right time to be thinking about density, because I am not arguing for the polluted, congested, substandard cities that a lot of people have had to contend with. I'm saying this is an inflection point in history, and we should be thinking about a different, better, more equal, more prosperous, more sustainable kind of city. I was planning director for Manhattan in the years that followed 9/11, and there was the same talk back then that everything was going to suburbanize, no one wanted to live in cities, and we had one of the biggest building booms in cities in our history. Same thing after 1918, you of course had the boom of the 1920s. To me, the question is how we bounce back. We're doing an affordable housing project for a pastor who lost over 100 congregants to COVID. How can we make the investments in our cities, mass transit, food, public health infrastructure, housing, that make our cities more equitable and more sustainable? All around California, Los Angeles is densifying around subway stations with five-story housing. So it's not a one-size-fits-all solution, but it is this idea that we need to create a world that's less car-dependent. It is a prosperity thing. We know from university towns that when people walk around, bump into each other, they actually create new companies and new ideas. Every city's got to look at itself and say, what would work for us? But I don't think they can do it alone. I think this is a moment where the federal government could step in and say, this is the right place to build more light rail, build more mixed income, affordable housing. So you create those magnets that bring people back and give those young people who are looking for choices, choices.
We have, over the last several months, seen cities demonized. President Trump speaks of them as dysfunctional and vats of violence and infection. It's added to the divide that's in the country right now between people in the rural parts of the country or even suburban parts of the country and cities. Does that make this a bad time for this message?
His view of cities is like some time warp from a 1970s sitcom. He seems to have no idea about how much violent crime has dropped in our cities. But look, the other thing is, when you look at this last election, look at what happened in cities in red states. Look at the Nebraska Electoral College split around Omaha. Look at how the Democrats won Georgia because of the way in which Georgia's urbanizing. Texas, why do people talk about Texas teetering and becoming a Democratic win someday? It's the cities. We got to think about that moment where a blue county meets a red county on the outskirts of Austin or the outskirts of Omaha, and think about how we're all going to live together. And even with the pandemic, when New York was hit so badly in March, everyone was like, oh, it's density. Look at what's happening now. We're seeing the spread of this pandemic across places that are not very dense at all.
Vishan Chakrabarty, he's Dean of the College of Environmental Design at Berkeley. Vishan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
And we'll link you to his TED Talks at hearnow.org. By the way, his 2013 terrific book is A Country of Cities. Your thoughts welcome. Send an email to letters@hearnow.org.
If you take a trip to the store next week, have a look at the magazine aisle. There you'll find on the cover of Time magazine the face of scientist and inventor Gitanjali Rao, the magazine's first ever Kid of the Year. Rao, who was 15 years old and from Colorado, was chosen from a list of 5,000 other amazing kids working to change the world. The honor is in recognition of Rao's commitment to creating scientific solutions, which includes a tool that detects lead in water. And Gitanjali Rao joins us now. Congrats on the honor.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Yes, Gitanjali, I want to know more about how your love of science and innovation came to be. We're reading when you were 10 years old, you created this tool to detect lead in water after learning about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. What drives you?
To this day, I can't really say that there was one aha moment when everything came together. But instead of that, it was almost like this learning and growing experience for me of combining my love of science and technology with putting a smile on someone's face. And now I basically use science for kindness every day. And that's really my goal, is to innovate for the better, innovate to make positive change in this world. And that's what makes me keep going. And that's what drives me, knowing that people out there do need help. And I'm willing to kind of take what I know and put that out there for other people to use.
Innovate for the better. You've created a host of other tools too, including one for cyberbullying and opioid addiction. Can you tell me a little bit about these projects and how those came about?
Absolutely. So my opioid addiction tool is called Epione, and it helps to diagnose prescription opioid addiction at an early stage using the latest developments in protein detection methods. So you basically put in a sample of bodily fluid, and you're able to receive your results on a mobile app in a user-friendly skill, along with action items, including a map of the nearest addiction centers. The idea from this really came from just a family friend who ended up getting into a car accident and becoming addicted to opioids. And by the time he knew about it, it was too late to do anything about it. And this was a constant problem that I saw all over the news, and I'm still seeing all over the news. And if no one else was going to solve it, then I needed to take the first steps. Similarly, with Kindly, which is my service to detect and prevent cyberbullying, it's based on developments in artificial intelligence and machine learning and is able to identify and point out any words or phrases that might be considered bullying. And it adapts to the latest terms, slang, as well as emojis and memes, what could be considered bullying, because it's built on a self-learning machine learning algorithm. So I really wanted to find a way to help stop cyberbullying because I wanted to create a safer place for teenagers to talk to each other.
I am really hearing in you this passion for finding solutions. You know, this year we've all been watching the work of scientists racing to create a vaccine for COVID-19. I'm just thinking about the way you think. You have had to think about how you would contribute to this effort.
I have. Yes, I totally have. So first of all, just like you said, a huge thank you to all the healthcare workers, researchers, and scientists for developing a vaccine in 9 months, which before this we never thought was possible. So those technological strides is what is the silver lining on this cloud. But if I look deeper into my contribution, I really want to look at some sort of data and predictive analytics approach for prioritization and distribution of these vaccines, just to make it more effective and efficient. So that might be something I'm working on in the next couple of months. But along with that, I also want to find ways to prevent more pandemics from in the future, just to make sure we don't have another crisis like COVID again. And I think the reason for this is because zoonotic diseases and cross-species transmission is going to become way more frequent in these next couple of years. So it's best to stop it now rather than having to go through it and then trying to find another way to stop it.
Gitanjali, I really look forward to seeing the work that you produce over the next few years. What are you into, though, when you're not working to save the world? Did I hear that you're actually working on your pilot's license?
I am, yes. I'm working on my pilot's license right now, and it is super fun. I can't drive a car, but I can fly a plane, which I think is
super exciting. Isn't that something?
Yeah, oh yeah. It's so cool. I feel like flying is easier, too.
What advice would you have for other budding innovators out there, especially in this moment that we're in?
So for other innovators out there, I would say dream big and then think back to reality. Because I'm quite literally living in a dream. These are things I never thought I would actually do, but here I am today accomplishing them. So dream big, come up with ideas, have fun with it, and then look at how you can do it because there's no one stopping you but yourself.
That's Gitanjali Rao, Time Magazine's first ever Kid of the Year. Congratulations. And hey, can I have your parents' phone number? I got to learn how to create a human like you.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I think you're doing pretty good, Tanya, but I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Curators of the new book, Black Futures, take on the ambitious effort of archiving this moment we're living in through photographs, music, and poetry. That's next time on Here and Now.